Okay. Morning, everybody.
Morgan.
I did not have the courage to use the blackboard, but still I took a picture of where George stopped yesterday, because the whole point of today is how do we get to an estimate of all these beautiful theoretical quantities, if at all. Okay. So as you may recall, yesterday there was some debate on the diffusive mixing coefficient and its value from theory is, I don't know if you can read it, but here there was about 6.5, and this is logarithmic in centimeters squared per second, 7-ish. And so as you will see, if we do seismology of stars, we get different values, and then we have to sort out, well, why that is, who is right and who is wrong, let's say, if at all, if we can formulate it in that way.
Whether reality is right or theory is right.
Well, that's what you said. Okay, let's see how that goes. I am pointing out here some of my students, because they let me use graphs that are unpublished, so I want to acknowledge that before we start. So the whole point is to go through this diagram. This is something I could have drawn on the blackboard. So how do we get from a Kepler light curve to parameters, very basic parameters in stellar models? And I'm really doing just the most simple case you can imagine. And that means that in the models we have these, let's say, six parameters. So metallicity, initial hydrogen composition, the age of the star, its mass, the core overshoot, and we have values and we have shapes, and that already interferes with the mixing in the near core region. So even if you pretend that you know all about input physics, if that would be perfect, then we are at minimum in a six-dimensional parameter space that we want to get estimates from. And then, of course, the whole thing is in this box, because the code just spits out result based on the input physics that you give, okay? So we have the computation of the models on the left, we have the observational facts on the right, and we wanna meet here. And for the moment, since I'm doing here only the scheme for massive stars, so this is a massive star audience. So this is only since a few years that we can do this, more or less routine-wise, since Kepler data gave us gravity mode oscillations. So I'm not doing pressure mode oscillations. For those who are not familiar with that difference, let me show you in a minute a graph. So we're going to start here today and then hope to reach that aspect. That was sort of the aim. And please interrupt me, because I have far too many things, and so I prefer that you guide me what you want to hear. Yeah.
When you say six parameters, I'm surprised you don't distinguish the four first, which are real parameters, and the two second, the two last ones, which are just
not real.
Not real.
Well, you could. What do you mean with real and not real?
The fourth one's not real either. It's all dependent, right?
Fucking yeah. Old
no, wait a second. Age is a thing, right?
I'm not the same age as the other people.
You could say in standard models that don't consider overshoots and mixing.
Those should be determined in terms of first principles.
What's first principles? Well, we did that yesterday. George, let me go back. George derived them from first principles. And I'm saying that stars don't do that.
And even if stars did that, MESA wouldn't do that.
Yeah. So
that's what she has to compare with. I'm stuck doing kinds of squares with MESA models.
Yeah.
Yuck.
Yeah. But also other models, Bill.
Well, I only hear the complaints about the MESA models.
Yes. Okay.
I mean, yeah, what you're saying is very true. In an idealized world, that would be true, but in fact...
It just doesn't work when you when you do a data-driven approach. It doesn't work like that, okay? So...
If you could cut out the boxes on the left.
Okay, let's go through this. I have far too many things, so you can interrupt me. One thing I already showed in the conference, this comes from Mesa, has basically three developed descriptions of how core overshoot can be treated for stars in with a convective core. So here is what I call the classical step overshoot function, where you basically just increase the convective core and the mixing is totally efficient. In this overshoot zone, you parametrize that with alpha over, let's say. Here you have an exponentially decreasing function where the mixing is not totally efficient in this box, but goes linearly in a log plot. Yeah? And here you have this double diffusive overshoot that has been invented, so to speak, by AGB people. So it comes from a totally different context than what I'm using it here for. That's a result of people doing AGB cell revolution and who measure third dredge up chemistry at the surface. And so they needed a more extended undershooting, as I tend to call it, if they have a convective outer envelope in their models. And so that was implemented in MESA for very different reasons than what we are trying to use it for here. But it's interesting for us to compare it with our models because we do need some, what I call, extra mixing in the stellar envelope. So this green here indicates that we do need a level of mixing to explain the observational facts from the gravity modes. Okay? So this was not, you know, considered before. It only came from gravity mode astroseismology. And so, as I already said, this is what we are trying to estimate now in a parameterized way. Another thing to do, which is what I'm here for to do with Tammy, who is not here today, she's climbing. But anyway, she has shown her profile that she gets from hydrodynamical simulations, where she follows how particles mix. And so that's something that my student is working on. To forget all about all this and to just see what these export from 2 or 3D hydro simulations give if we were to plug it in MESA. So that's just to set the scene. And here are some helium profiles because Stefan asked me. Yeah. So if you do these three different types of overshoot descriptions, as the star evolves, its core recedes. And you create a mu gradient zone, as explained yesterday by George. And that zone is critical to predict stellar revolution. It's also critical to trap the gravity modes that travel through the star. And so you have a bit of a difference between a step overshoot, hydrogen and helium profile, and the two more diffusive exponential ones. So you can see that as the star evolves. And so estimating, for me, the shape of the overshoot is the same as drawing a hydrogen helium profile and determine how much helium there will be in the star after the main sequence. Okay? Yeah?
So the blue curves, it looks like there's like little steps in them. Is that real? And if so, is that also happening in the other?
You mean here?
Yeah, especially on the
break
graph.
Oh, here, yes. This is the thumbs. And so there, I think that's just numerics, okay, to be honest.
But that's a real output of the code.
Yeah.
It's not just the way that's being plotted.
No, no. Okay. That's our real output. But near the thumbs, your star, so that's really where the core starts shrinking. Yeah, when it starts to behave a bit different in the center. But I wouldn't, you know, we're not going to measure this in real data. So it doesn't make me worry too much. Okay.
So, but Connie, we are, like, the actual difference between the step and the exponential, that is probable by current...
Well, that's what we are trying.
Okay.
So the whole aim of my thesis is answering the question, can we distinguish between these? And then another profile that comes from 3D hydro simulations, which tend to be localized very often, not always, but if it's 3D, because you can't do a whole star in evolution in 3D, okay? I'm not yet answering the question, as we wouldn't need to worry about. There was some discussion yesterday on an HR diagram, and so we tend to draw a keel diagram, which is not an HR diagram, but plots the gravity versus the effective temperature. And the reason is that we can measure this directly from spectroscopy. So for massive star seismology, you tend to have a star in such a diagram with error bars. And as you can see, the evolutionary track here, the one with the color codes here, is drawn for a step overshoot. So you make a bigger core if you have an overshoot value, while the dashed here and the orange one are for these exponentially overshooting models. And so you clearly see a difference in the evolutionary track. But that difference is typically something that is less than an error bar on a spectroscopic measurement of the gravity and the temperature. So I'm just showing this to tell you that we are no longer using the effective log G from spectroscopy because the oscillations do better. But a posteriori, we do check if the results that we get for the model fall in the measured log G, the effective position of the star in the HR diagram. Yeah, that's just something I wanted to express here. Then what makes the whole point so nice for the for this topic, and this is why it has been recently applied, that's because we can do gravity mode astroseismology now. So here you see the eigenfunctions of three modes. The green one is a radial mode, so just up, that's the easiest oscillation you can have. And you see that its displacement vector makes its highest amplitude, and this was normalized to have one at the surface. Yeah? Biggest amplitude in the envelope region of a star, no transversal displacement, no transversal velocity for that reason. Also not for the red curve, which is a pressure mode. Yeah, so it has it's a dipole pressure mode in a two solar mass model. And the blue one is a gravity mode with a high radial order, you could say intermediate. So if you normalize that at one in the radial component of the eigenfunction, then you get a value that's typically 10 times bigger in the transversal displacement. That's what Jacqueline already showed also this week for those who were in her session. Yeah? So such modes have really horizontal displacement that is dominant, factor 10 higher than radial displacement. Yeah? So that makes gravity mode astroseismology different from red giant or helioseismology, let's say, where we scale the sun. And here is a drawing of the sort of the energy of the mode as a function of its depth. And then you see this is sort of the probing power of the mode. Yeah? So it probes the near core region, which is why we can do estimates of this new gradient zone with gravity modes in a far better way than with, for instance, this red mode here, which has low probing power. Okay. So
where the curve stop, is that where the convective core is?
Yeah, so this is the convective core because the G-modes don't propagate in there, but they do propagate all the way up to this new gradient zone, which is why we can estimate things in that zone. Okay. So where can we apply this? Well, we can apply it in B stars that have such gravity modes and in F stars. That also, well, for me, a massive star is a star that is born with a convective core. So it's not so massive for most of you, but as it happens, there are many more F-type stars than B-type stars in the Kepler Bay.
Why not A-type stars?
A-type stars, because the well, we can also do A-type stars.
Yeah. Yeah? The
yes, there we have the excitation of the modes, which I will not discuss here. I'm just using quakes as we observe them. There, they the excitation is dominant for pressure type modes. Yeah, there are also A-type stars that have both gravity modes and pressure modes. And so what I'm telling here is also done for A-type. You are right. Yeah, I should make it BAF-type stars. Yeah, it's just more difficult, and I will tell you why. So I come back to this diagram, and let's go to the data. Yeah. We start with the data, and then we have to find the frequencies. And what was so hard in the past has now been overcome thanks to Kepler. We have to label for each and every frequency that we have the wave numbers, so the degree of the mode, the azimuthal order of the mode, and the radial order of the mode. And that's really hard if you do not have many frequencies. And so nowadays we can do it from the recognition of patterns in the frequency determination. And that's in fact why A stars are so hard, because this is bothering us. Okay? It's not impossible, but it's bothering us.
But it gets easier at F, or F is still hard?
It's so we have plenty of A-type stars with Kepler data, but they're mostly P-mode oscillators. Some do have gravity modes, and we can do this identification from regular patterns in the gravity modes.
Okay.
And so this is not trivial for A-type stars, but it has been done for a few of them.
But F, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Oh, for F, we can, I'll show you the regularity.
It just seems kind of weird that it's kind of okay for B and okay for F, but A is hard.
That's because the F-type stars, they have a much shallower outer convective zone than the A-type stars.
And that's where the confusion is coming from.
Well, partly. But not entirely, because we also have very many frequencies excited for the A-type stars. And so, too many, so to speak. And then we are just, it's a bit messy, yeah?
I think another thing is that the P-mode pulsators, it's often actually harder to recognize the pattern in the data. A lot of them are rapidly rotating, and that totally changes the pattern. The oscillation mode frequencies that you get—that's what.
I guess what I'm wondering is, most things like go smoothly right across there. So
well, the F and the B stars are the G mode pulsators, that's where we can recognize the pattern a bit easier thanks to Connie's work.
Yeah.
So it's just the pressure modes that mess you up in
it. I spent my whole career on this two words so far. And that's really tough, which is why we were stuck also from the ground. But maybe I should just show a light curve and then you see. So here are data, and if anyone would like to try, I strongly advise you to go to the Kepler archive. The Kepler data is public. And so here you see a snapshot pixel mask, raw pixel data as they come from the satellite. For a star, for a specific quarter of Kepler data. So every quarter the satellite had to turn to have its position with respect to the sun corrected so that the solar light wouldn't influence the detector. And what the Kepler data analysis team has done is make a beautiful automated pipeline, but of course from the viewpoint of planet hunting. Yeah. And so what you want to do for each star is have the optimal signal-to-noise ratio in the light curve. But there's signal and there's noise. And optimal signal over noise can be achieved in two ways. You optimize the signal, and that's what we are doing for seismology, or you reduce the noise. And ideally you do both, and that ratio comes into play in a different way, because finding planets is searching for small, tiny dips with one periodicity. An astroseismologist wants to have as many frequencies as possible. So this is a very different way of analyzing a light curve. And so for that reason, we have discovered, as we learned how to use Kepler data, that it's by far better to add more pixels. So for every star that we try to analyze, the green box here is the flux that has been measured by the satellite during 270 exposures of 6 point something seconds. They are stacked on board of the satellite, and you download such a map, so to speak. And the dark green is what the pipeline of Kepler gives you in the archive. We don't use that. We use our own optimal mask, and that has more pixels. So all these yellow ones have more signal. But the signal-to-noise ratio is worse if you want to hunt for planets. It's better if you want to find oscillation frequencies. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So these are sky pixels, and then those little curves there are the time histories of the pixel strength.
Yeah. So these are the measured fluxes, but they are stacked on board because the telemetry doesn't allow you to have every measurement of 6 seconds and 1.5 second readout.
So they're stacked.
There's tiny time series per pixel assembled on board and then sent to the ground. So this gives you a cadence, as we call it, of almost half an hour, which is fine to do gravity mode oscillations. So for pressure mode oscillations, pressure modes have much shorter periods. You get such stamps every minute. So that's typically what solar type oscillation people get. Okay. So you basically have advantage to build your own data analysis pipeline for this type of work. And then, so you have chunks of 3 months. Every quarter you have a light curve, right? And then you have to stitch them. And this sounds trivial, but it's not. If you look at this light curve, this is just one Kepler star for 100 days. In practice, we have 1,500 days. And so you see all the oscillations, beating against each other, destructively, constructively, and so on. So we have long beating patterns that go over these 3 months, right? And so having these yellow pixels added to the green ones really helps us because the detrending becomes much simpler, much better in the frequency regime that we are interested in. So if any one of you wants to do gravity mode seismology, then just use our data analysis code. You can get it if you want it. And then, of course, you have this light curve, and it goes on 15 times longer than this one. And that's the data you have. That's what you have to start from if you want to model, if you want to find the core overshoot, let's say. So then we just apply classical time domain astronomy, and we do frequency analysis on this light curve. And so an important quantity is the Nyquist frequency, which tells you, well, if you measure every half hour, then there's a limit in the temporal variability that you can discover. You will not discover variability with periods of 10 seconds if you measure every half hour, right? Because it's totally washed out, okay? So basically, well, you can go further than this type of frequency, but that's technical. I will not go into these details. So if you don't know how that works, then we go to some mathematical principles. We compute the Fourier transform of this light curve. A Fourier transform is defined here. That's beautiful integrals. But of course, the light curve is not infinitely long. And we also do not know this flux of the star, which is this function x, at every time. Yeah. In practice, we have a discrete number of ti x at ti. Yeah, that's fine. But of course, for Kepler, this is way better than for ground-based data. If I look at my original light curves of older SPBs, then typically you have to cut here 90% of the data, and that's what you have if you do a single-site observation. So that's horrible. I don't want to do that anymore. Because it gives problems in the analysis that we don't face anymore now.
Sorry, is aliasing an issue? I mean, if you had a strong signal that something above the Nyquist frequency, could it be aliased in
Yes,
here?
Yes, it is. That's why I'm showing these slides from my lecture. So, I mean, it's, Kepler is beautiful, but it still has a finite, time, and it measures only every half hour, and sometimes the satellite has to turn, and you have interruptions. So there is what we call a window function, and that translates into a spectral window in Fourier space. It's beautiful compared to ground-based data, but it's still existing, and it has a width. So the whole point of doing this is that if you have a sinusoidal signal here, then in Fourier space you get a delta peak, infinitely narrow delta peak, and it's not infinitely narrow, not even for Kepler, because the width of this peak is determined by the total time base of your data set. But still, it's very narrow. 1/4 years in practice. So it is an issue, but we have so many frequencies that we can detect. We are swamped with frequencies that this is not an issue in practice.
Well, it also has to do with the, like the power spectrum of the intrinsic fluctuations, right? So if there's something that's just beyond the Nyquist frequency, that's really strong, then it could be a problem. Yeah. But it, I mean, so there must be some...
We are not here, because the frequencies we're dealing with here, you know, Nyquist is about 25 per day, and our G modes in these stars are typically between 0.5 and 3 per day. So very far away from that. There are technicalities that imply that you can do super Nyquist seismology, but as said, I'm only doing the very simplistic, easiest case here. Okay. So in practice, you have a sum of sine functions, because you have multiple modes that each have their frequency, and if you Fourier transform the light curve, these will stand out as almost delta peaks, but not entirely so. And we have no handle on the amplitudes of the modes. This was also covered by Jacqueline. We do not know how to predict amplitudes of gravity modes because we don't understand the nonlinear saturation of the modes. Okay? So basically, we're only working with the frequencies. Let me skip through all this and go to data sets. Okay? So you have already seen this graph. This is just an assembly of a few B stars observed with Kepler, where the gray is the light curve after stitching, and the red is the Fourier transform of the light curve. And so what you can see and what makes it different for people who do stochastically excited modes is that there, like for the sun, you sort of have a comb of frequencies, and they almost have the same amplitude for my standards. This is not at all the case for these stars. Like take this star, there is clearly a dominant mode here, one here, but then here, it's almost invisible, but when you zoom in, these are highly significant frequencies. So it means that you have to do what we call a pre-whitening. So you do a Fourier transform, you identify this frequency as the dominant one, and then you're going to your light curve and you're going to fit it with this frequency, and that signal you take out of it. Then you have a pre-whitened light curve, as we call it. Then you recompute this Fourier transform, you identify the second frequency, you pre-whiten, and so on. Okay? So that's something that we have to do. While solar-like oscillation astroseismologists, they just compute their Fourier transform and they see all the peaks because they're all at almost equal height. They don't have to do this. And they just can scale the sun, which is so much easier. So that's why most people who work in astroseismology work on solar-type stars. It is so much easier from the data analysis point of view and also from the modeling point of view because they just scale the sun. And that gives you then, quick and easy results, so to speak. But beautiful, huh? I've also done that. So what do you do? You do pre-whitening, you identify a frequency, the dominant peak in your Fourier transform, you make a linearly square fit, right? And so you leave the amplitude and the phase of the mode free, yeah? And then you compute the residual, as we call it. So your data minus the estimated fit for that frequency, you take it out and you Fourier transform your residual, you find the second frequency, and so on, and the third, and the fourth, and the fifth, and so on. And you go on. Until when? Until your amplitude here reaches the noise level. And the noise level in Kepler data is at a few parts per million. So you go on and on and on. Yeah. And how do you do that best? Well, you find a frequency in your Fourier transform, but as it was said, there is still a spectral window, so you don't know if the frequency that you found in your Fourier transform is the actual frequency of the star to within the frequency precision, right? So within that range, 1/4 years time-based, because that's basically the rough frequency precision that you can get, you have to scan all these frequencies to see what's the best fit. So in practice, we do a non-linearly square fit, where we also leave the frequency free, but the starting value is the number that you get out of your Fourier transform, okay? And here is a sort of an estimate of the frequency precision, and it goes as 1/4 the total time base. That's normal. The longer you measure, the higher your frequency precision. But it also depends on the amplitude of the mode. If your mode has a 100 times higher amplitude than another mode, well, then its frequency can be determined with better precision. Depends on the number of data points. Yeah? And it depends on this sigma here is the sort of the standard deviation of the noise. Yeah, it depends on the noise level in your data set. Okay? Yeah?
I understand that, but is the lifetime of the modes infinite, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, it's 100 thousands of days. So for these modes, we just assume it's infinite. If you don't have that, so for solar type stochastically excited modes, which can also occur for G-modes, but that's yet another topic, then this is not a good approximation of the error, and you get it with the square root of t. So it's worse, because you re-excite and damp all the time. So then you don't make profit of the length of the time series in the same way. But
so from your data, you say you assume, but you also kind of know that the lifetime is long.
Yes, if we compute lifetimes from non-adiabatic excitation of G modes, then we get more than 10,000, 100,000 years, right?
That's theory.
That's theory, yeah. But we see them unchanged in amplitude over 4 years. Of course, that's not, but it's good enough to approximate that. And well, to be honest, we are really in deep trouble in the sense that this frequency precision here, even if I were to make it 10 times longer, if our approximation is not good, the theory cannot handle that precision anyway. So I'm not very worried, because we are far away from dealing with the precision of the Kepler data if I go back to my quest, which is to estimate a core overshoot, for instance. Yeah.
Doesn't the goodness of fit of your nonlinear least squares give you a measurement or a test of whether the amplitude is constant over the...
Yeah, it's constant, as far as we can measure.
Right, but I mean, if you got a fit, but it was a bad fit. Right.
No, these fits are excellent.
No. If you were to, I'm just saying, it's a way of testing with the data whether the amplitude is indeed constant for this
sure.
mode
yeah.
over this whole window. And,
yeah.
And the fact that you get good fits would tell
yes.
you that.
Yes. So we get more than good enough fits to assume that they are infinitely long in lifetime.
Right. So it's not that you're completely reliant on this theory expectation.
No. I'm not relying on any theory. I'm not that type of person.
I thought that was the mode switches.
Sorry?
I thought that was the mode switches.
Mode switches? What do you mean by that?
Like, so they change the distribution.
Well, yes, we see that. And we also see nonlinear effects in the data because the data are so good. But I'm not bothered by that at all, because really we're only trying to fit the dominant, let's say, 10 to 200 frequencies, and they are just really stable and nicely behaving for these type of stars. Yeah. Okay, so that's done, and don't reinvent the wheel. Our quotes are there to help you should you want to try that for yourself or students or whatever. This, as said, has been blocking us, because if you can't pass this step, then you can't go here, and then you can't treat all that. Okay, so now we can do that from recognizing patterns. Why is that? High order gravity modes in a star that is, in the simplest case, not magnetic, not rotating, convective core, radiative envelope, in that very simplistic case, they are predicted to have a regular pattern in period. Okay, this has been known since Tassoul, 1980s. And so, if you measure enough frequencies, then you can recognize this pattern. That was the whole problem of gravity mode seismology from the ground. After 10 years, I got then maybe 4 frequencies for a star, you know. And, you know, to make a pattern out of that is not very convenient, okay? Now we have hundreds of frequencies. So here's, again, that same star, where all the red bars here are frequencies deduced from this nonlinear pre-whitening process. And to guide your eye, you see these dashed lines, and they are almost equally spaced in period. So our HR diagram for us, so to speak, is a period spacing versus periods diagram of the modes, rather than a log GT effective, because this tells me really what kind of star it is, if you are familiar with this type of data. So you see here the points with very, very conservative error bars. And you see for this star, the period spacing, so the difference between these modes in periods is almost constant, and it's about 5,300 seconds, to give you an idea. This is a B star, yeah? And so if you see this type of pattern, then you know, oh, these are modes that have the same degree, because that's what you expect to see as a pattern, as indicated in this old formula here that was deduced for, again, the very simplistic case. No rotation. All stars rotate, even this one, but very slowly in this case. No magnetic field. That's fine. 90% fulfill that. Yeah. A convective core is there in a radiative envelope. Okay. And so what you can see is that this period spacing is a function of the degree of the mode. So the degree of the mode just tells you the number of nodal lines at the surface. Yeah. And what we see, and this is new for us, that's not something I had or anybody else had foreseen, as it turns out, gravity mode pulsators detected from Kepler are dominantly dipole pulsators. So that makes our life so much easier, because you can predict more or less from the models where this period spacing would lie for a dipole mode. And if you then look at this formula here, if it would be a quadrupole mode, there would be an analytical scaling factor between them, and you would recognize it. So from this basic value here, we know more or less what the mass of the star is already, what its core mass is. Now, why is this spacing occurring? That has to do with the integral of the buoyancy Brunt-Weissler frequency, as you see here. So this gives a direct handle on this quantity. The measured value of this period spacing here gives you the integral of that quantity. Okay? So you're deep inside the star, as probing metal.
I'm always very confused about these mode numbers. So n is the number of the radial
order? Yes, so you have 3 quantum numbers, the radial order, yeah, that's the number of nodal surfaces inside the star as the eigenfunction. L is the spherical harmonic degree, so it's just the number of nodal lines on the stellar surface. okay, which is one in this case. Right. So your star, I didn't bring movies, which has all these beautiful movies, but there's one nodal line, let's say the equator of the star, and your mass is shaking up and down, but in such a way that you have horizontal motion being dominant. So that's what happens for this star.
So L is always equal to 1, but N varies.
Yeah, so each of these points has a different radial order. So a different number of nodal surfaces inside your star. That's what the stars are doing, obviously.
If you had a much higher degree in L, would you be able to see that photometrically at all?
Well, so you can... These are the amplitudes in PP. This is a very strong pulsator, yeah. And so the L scales here, but that gives you a handle on the period spacing. The problem is that we can't predict amplitudes from our theory, and so there are two effects. There's the intrinsic excitation amplitude that we cannot compute, and then there's the geometry. Because you look upon the star, and you if you have two nodal lines, you cancel out more. But that we can compute, if we have the inclination angle of the star, which we in general don't. So the geometric factor would not imply that quadruple modes, we would see them in Kepler data. If they are excited to the same intrinsic amplitude than dipole modes, right? And so there are various stars where we have higher degree modes but in the space.
Higher meaning two or three.
Two or three.
Not 20.
I have so much work with such easy patterns for dipole modes that I...
In the easy case of solar
yes.
things, we see data for L equals...
Three, two, up to three, four even.
You know, four sort of getting...
It's already, yeah, but so these, lower. Yeah, low Ls in general, yeah.
I'd like to understand this average value pi zero, which does not involve any density or mass in the...
Well, that's here. Here's the definition of...
This is the frequency itself, but this averaging procedure...
Yes.
R1 and R2...
Yes.
...does not distinguish inertia of the region. I mean, do you assume that between R1 and R2 you have R1 and R2 could be as large as the...
No, R1 and R2 are denoted the propagation cavity of the G-modes,
yeah,
right?
That's going to be a large scale.
That's large scale, yes.
And this comes out of theory?
Yes. It's an asymptotic approximation where you are in the limit of the frequency going to zero. Then you get that, because you can delete terms in your perturbed equation of motion. And so, of course, we are never in this limit mathematically. And so this is also, this is not constant. This is not purely constant, but almost so. Yeah. So it really works well. Yeah.
Can I ask, so do I understand correctly that the value of the peak, which is just next to the pole, mm-hmm. will be way more affecting the P0 than the rest?
Yes, this sets the propagation cavity of your modes.
So it doesn't really matter what you have above. So that means that when you receive your P0, it mainly constrains you have the core, but not really anything what you have in the world.
Yeah, so here you see again this kernel, as we call it. That's the mode eigenfunction, its energy, so to speak. And so it's mainly probing the core region and not the outer envelope so much.
So, for example, if you will try to... So, assume that you receive this M with some precision from your observations.
Yes.
So, can you say, like, how that precision or error will affect the error in the M inferred in the envelope? Like, if you will say, we're reconstructing
yeah.
the model...
Well, I'm not constraining N directly. We are not... Ideally, you would want to do that. Like what helioseismologists do is invert the solar frequencies to get the sound speed profile. Ideally, we would want to invert gravity modes and reconstruct the profile N. But that's not what we are doing for the moment. We are not yet there. that's something we would like to do. But this is a very spiky profile, and there we enter all the things that undoubtedly were discussed last week when I wasn't here about the core boundary and you know, the extent of a core that is extending. Yeah, but so we are not there as far that we can reconstruct the profile itself. We're just doing its integral over the cavity as an sort of average right now. Okay. Yeah.
So, but trying to tie this thing together with last week's discussions, that spike is sort of giving you an indication of the top of the convective zone.
That's right. And this determines what kind of modes can propagate.
So if we change the size of the convective zone, we're going to move that spike around, and that's going to change R1.
Yes.
Your integral, that's going to change all sorts of other stuff that you are sensitive to.
So I know.
That's how you're getting back to the size of the convective.
Yes.
Sorry to steal your punchline.
No, that's...
Because that was a lot of confusion.
Yeah. Okay.
So what's responsible for the spike? I mean, is that like the transition from the radiative envelope to the convective zone?
Yes.
Okay.
The composition gradient.
It's
okay. Go back one second. It's that grad U. It's huge there and small everywhere else.
Okay. So this was what George yesterday, the importance of this comes in also when you study mixing, because that's what sets also the mixing in the near core boundary. Okay, and it also comes in here. Yeah. Okay, this is how we can recognize the age of the star in a graph. If you measure the period spacing from the data, and you more or less know what kind of star you are dealing with, this purple prediction here is what you would get at the ZAMS, let's say. So at the ZAMS, your star has not yet had much time to shrink its core, and there is no mu gradient zone, right? This red one is the opposite. It's at the very end when you almost lost all your hydrogen in the core. So the core has shrunk a lot, and you have a big extended mu gradient zone. And so all these fluctuations, now you are no longer at constant period spacing. Why? Because in this zone here, your gravity modes get trapped. So you see structure in your period spacing diagram due to trapping of gravity modes. Yeah. And so if you measure something that looks like this, or that looks like this, it's telling you how much the core has had time to shrink, because the trapping of the mode. So if I then go back to this star, well, there's not much structure here, not at all. So this must be a young star. This quite straightforwardly comes out of the data. And that's what you get also if you do the modeling. Yeah.
So there's not much structure there, but there is significant structure.
That's right.
And so you're going to guess that.
Yeah. Okay. That's because our simplistic approach, core, no mixing, radiative envelope, is not correct. And that's how we estimate the mixing. Yeah.
And the graph on the right, that comes from solving for the oscillation modes.
Yes.
Completely. It's not the simple theory that you put on the last slide.
This is simple theory, this one. So what we do is grids of models with these
parameters. But it's not a pulsation.
And then you end here.
Yeah.
Yeah. In an adiabatic approximation, you predict your frequencies. And so if you have your frequencies, you have the periods. And then you compute the period spacing theoretically. And that's what you see in this graph. OK? For dipole modes. So that's how we do this modeling scheme, basically. And here is how you do, this is an example from the, I highly advise you the MESA school, because that's where we do the full day of all these computations. It's on the web, it's all public, so you can do all that. And all the students fantastically did this exercise during the day. So here you see when you start at the SAMS and you burn hydrogen systematically, how the structure of your period spacing diagram changes across the main sequence. This is for a 3 solar mass star. So once again, by simply looking at the structure in the delta P versus P of the detected modes, you have a lot, because you have the basic value of the period spacing, which is somehow connected with the total mass of the star, and that is roughly connected to the core mass, roughly, and there you have deviations, yeah? And the level of these pipes here tells you, or gives you, sort of a handle on the age, because it gives you an estimate of the central hydrogen fraction, okay?
I guess the costs are successive correspond to successive n values, yeah? So there's nothing in between.
That's right. So these are all the dipole modes of consecutive radial order gravity modes. Okay.
It's funny that for 10% hydrogen content you get this.
That's the mode trapping. Yes.
For the other cases, you don't get that.
Yes, but so the difference in this has to do with the position of the mode trapping. So you're at high radial order, or, well, between 10 and 50, let's say. So you have a lot of nodal points in your star, and whether or not they are in the new gradient zone makes a difference of the trapping.
Yeah, but you can say that for any lifetime.
Yes, that's right. But if you change slightly the model, another mass, for instance, this pattern changes. Yeah. And so that's a way to estimate globally the mass. But we have degeneracies. I can come back to that if you want. Because I make it sound very easy now. Yeah?
Same point. So the same on X sphere point one, it seems symmetric around the red line, whereas the others in like
4.6,
it's not symmetric.
Yes, so that red line is in fact the prediction made by Tasul. You don't need to do any oscillations to estimate this spacing, right?
Where does the symmetry change?
Well, if you change x, then the star has had a different time.
It's a spike and then a long thing and then a spike and then a long thing and a spike and then a long thing.
Yeah, because the trapping is different of the modes. Because the mu gradient zone has a different extent and mixing.
It's not intuitive why it's asymmetric there and symmetric at X.
No, I wouldn't assign a conclusion to that particular aspect. Because if you look at these graphs for different models, then you see these spikes all over the place, but this particular pattern isn't unique, let's say. Okay? Okay, so this is from Mai's thesis, and what she's showing here is, because my aim is to see if we can deduce the different overshoot shapes, that's the whole point. And so here you see the period spacing pattern for these three that each have their parameters to give in to the code. And so we have used a step overshoot, and then the exponential overshoot, the parameter there is typically factor 10 different to have a similar behavior, and this extended, so that's this double overshoot. Just to show you how different the period spacing is, and that you of course have to compare with the data, can you distinguish yes or no, keeping in mind that you're assuming perfect knowledge of the input physics, which is not at all true. We're working on it. We haven't sorted out if we can ever do this, but we are trying, okay? So then rotation comes in, to couple back to Juna's remark. It's not perfectly constant. Why is it not constant? Because of the mode trapping, yeah? That's the mu gradient effect. But if you now start to have rotation, rotation shifts the frequency of oscillations. You all know that from music. So if you introduce rotation, you shift your frequencies and hence your period of the modes, and then you get a different period spacing, of course, because the periods themselves change. And so this is what you get if you do the effect of rotation, not in the equilibrium model, which we here compute with MESA, but whatever code you want, but when you compute your oscillations, you do a three-dimensional perturbation of your equilibrium star, and at that stage you introduce the rotation. And we do that for only for stars which George yesterday said this is safe. Because I mean the simplest case, really, okay? So here is a plot up to 20% critical rotation frequency, and you see that this pattern gets tilted. Yeah, so rotation shifts your frequency, it shifts them to higher frequencies, lower periods, which means that the period spacings become smaller. That's what you expect and that's what you see. So the tilt of this diagram gives you a handle on the rotation frequency, where? In the near core region, because that's where you have the probing power of the G-modes. Okay? And so then we have another effect. That's not the tilt, but mixing. Now I'm at the mixing where the graph, unfortunately, they wiped out the blackboard. So you have various types of description and beautiful theory that is where George took out two things. Remember, he had the strong coupling, weak coupling, but there's many more effects and whatever you can imagine. And they all have their factor. And it's all nicely in Mesa. And first I was naive and I thought, I'm just going to treat them all and I'm going to estimate all these diffusion parameters. That is quite hopeless. So for the moment, we're doing a very rudimentary approach. We're just going to try and see if we can estimate the global level of mixing, whatever the cause is. I'm not doing any interpretation for the moment of this coefficient. But as you have seen yesterday, in theoretical models, it is estimated to be of the order of 1 million to 10 million centimeters squared per second. That just comes out of theory.
And Cody, can I ask, so this D mix will be for the envelope, not the envelope, will be for the envelope as the
yes.
global.
Yes.
Because this is why I asked before if you found N well for the envelope, and I understand that you couldn't find N well for the envelope.
No, that's because of this. So here you see patterns of the modes, period spacing versus period, when you have no mixing in the envelope, nothing, okay? And then you go higher and higher mixing, and here you are only at 10 centimeters per second, centimeters squared per second. And you see that you have washed out the mu gradient. So if you wash it out, then you don't have this mode trapping, and you get rid of your dips, right? And so real stars show dips for some of them, and some pulsators do not show dips. And so there is a degeneracy here, and that's why I think we can agree with the theory, because this and this, for me as a seismologist, is almost the same. And so if I put it up higher, then it doesn't affect my spacing because it's constant anyway. So I can't give an actual value once all the dips have been washed out, and they are washed out quite fast in terms of value of mixing. So let me go back to my original simplistic drawing. What I'm measuring is this green, right?
But you measure it through the value of n, where the gradient of mu is coming, right? And the
yes.
value of n is least identified at the envelope.
It's least, but it's still affected. Because there is still, where is my slide on that? Here, it's not zero here. There is an effect, yeah?
But in the envelope, the composition is homogeneous, so I'm not actually sure what your mixing is doing.
Yeah, what matters is the mixing and that composition gradient.
Yeah, it's...
That's what's important. That's what's really constraining.
Okay.
It's not... The composition is not constant right near the edge of the projection zone. So it's going to show up there.
So what?
And the other, so that means that grad, so basically
here.
You're saying that grad mu is zero most of the places.
Yeah.
So So you're not sensitive to the composition gradient because there isn't one. That's exactly true. But n depends on the thermal gradients and things. So you still have a value for n. You just don't have the composition term in there. You've got thermal terms. You go back to the definition of n.
I think it would be nice to see the profile or something like that. Because
but grad mu does become non-zero near the convection zone.
So that mixing in the envelope actually increases the composition gradient in the envelope. It doesn't decrease it, it increases.
It's only very near the convection.
Yeah, I mean, we need something here for this extra mixing.
It softens the mu gradient only. It doesn't destroy it, it softens it.
Yes.
Well, it's totally different. In the outer envelope, it increases the mu gradient.
Yeah, so
No.
Well,
there is no mu gradient in the outer envelope.
No.
So why is there any mixing in the outer envelope? Next question. Why do you want?
No, it won't.
No, that's because of our limitations in MISA.
No need to be facetious.
So that's why I'm looking at this right now, because that might be better, because we need something of extra mixing here.
The
green is just because we need to add something very simplistic, and as it happens, the simplest thing to do is to just add extra mixing, and it might, whether it stops here or not, that will be sufficient for me.
The green part is driven by observations.
Yeah.
Also, I don't understand what it does to the profile.
There's a difference.
Yes, I understand your point. So for the moment, I'm assuming a constant profile, which is not at all what we should be doing. But that is to estimate somehow the level that we need here to recover the structure in the period spacing diagram.
Constant profile, constant abundance profile.
No. You two are talking about totally different things.
Yes.
And you just can't see it. Okay. Connie's talking about the profile of the mixing coefficient.
Yes.
You're talking about the abundance profile.
Yeah.
Yes, but they are connected.
Yes, but the abundance profile is not flat. You assume a flat diffusivity, because that's the simple option in MESA.
Yes.
Where there's no abundance gradient, it's not going to do anything, so it doesn't matter.
No.
So, actually, so
but where this mixing is effective is where there actually is this.
Yes.
So it's just that dark blue green boundary. So what? Is that not right? You object, Bill.
It's important to remember that this overshoot region, the blue triangle, is different from where there's actually a composition gradient. So there's a composition gradient in all the parts of the star that were once convective, because it's convective zone
receipt.
Okay, so this green mixing will affect that part of the star where there is a composition gradient due to this receding core.
Yeah, that's actually what I was going to ask about the time dependence of this mixing. So
all these other
ways of doing mixing have to do, they respond directly to the current state of the star, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And your mixing is a constant, and what I'm asking is it constant in time, or is it switched on at some point?
We have two or three stars. So what we are doing now is trying to do the same work for stars across the main sequence, because then that's the only way to get a handle of how such mixing profile would change during the main sequence. But don't forget that this is also depending on how fast the rotation of the star is, and so we can't decouple all that for the moment. We are not at that stage at all. It's just first probing.
But in your model, so like the ones you showed in May's thesis, where you were varying d-mix, forward. Keep going.
Different flavors of overshoot.
Oh, wait, I could have sworn I saw this, like there was a series of plots on the right-hand side where you were varying log d-mix.
I keep going and you tell me when to stop.
Okay.
Yes.
Keep going.
Yeah,
you're right there. Yeah. So were these log B mixes applied throughout the evolution? I mean, your XC equals 0.2 implies
this
the time.
This is assuming it doesn't change in time. I know it's wrong.
Well, no. I just want to know what you did.
Yeah.
That's all.
This is a constant, mixing coefficient across the main sequence.
Okay.
Because we, as said, we have two stars. What are you saying, Bill?
When she was those little green bars at the bottom that were in fact three different cases that you showed. Yeah. On the far right, the green bar had gone away. There was no green bar anymore on the far right. She had replaced it by a more sophisticated, more kludgy form of mixing near the convection zone. It has, so on the far right, this is none of this stuff that is making Norbert Mothers crazy about mixing out in the radiative zone. That went away. The green bars are temporary attempts to model something with what was in Mesa at the time.
I just wanted to understand that one slide. Where she was very long the mix, and I wondered, just wanted to know.
The green bar. The one on the right, all of those things are recomputed at each time step.
That makes much more sense.
The ones on the left are always doing the best you could do. Yeah. Now the thing is moving towards something that is focused in much more on the region about the convective boundary. That's what you need to focus on.
Yeah. Okay, so the thing she showed was the green bars on the left.
Yes.
And what you're telling me is what Mesa is going
to
do now.
Well, no, that was just a temporary thing to see how sensitive you would be. But those green bars were not doing anything away from the convective boundary.
I understand.
Okay.
I mean, but what I was getting at was more what Jim was saying, is that, you know, that depending on when you apply the mixing, over time, you know, that these other ways of applying mixing respond to where the convective boundary is right now, at whatever time they're applied.
Yeah.
Whereas this is something that doesn't know about that. It just mixes. No. Whatever it finds, it mixes.
Yeah, right. And my whole point was to estimate George's basic value. Very first estimate, and we are very far away from each other, and we have to try and understand why that is. Okay?
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. Can I say something about that? So the numbers George quoted yesterday were for 20 solar mass stars.
I know.
These are a few solar masses. Also, those numbers were in the envelope, sort of away from the composition gradient zone, whereas what you're really concerning is in the composition gradient zone.
But somehow they have to meet. And so I've asked him, I talked to him yesterday afternoon because he wanted to understand. And so the question is, if you look at the profile that Tammy, for instance, gives, the diffusive mixing profile is as a function of depth, right? And there's a very strong dip in the near core boundary. And I think that we're not in contradiction with each other, because that's four orders of magnitude difference than what you have in the outer envelope, depending on how the forcing of her waves. Okay, she's doing gravity waves and the mixing that may induce. So next week, before I go home, George promised me a profile in the near core region, because I want to see the values there.
For one of these lower mass stars.
Yes, for three solar mass stars. Yeah.
I think the sort of like zoomed out point is that the seismic data from the gravity modes demands extra mixing in the in this core boundary region. Mm-hmm. And that we all agree on. Okay.
Which is fairly new.
How much?
How much? That's the question.
10. How much? Connie hasn't actually made that point yet, so I'd like to.
Exactly.
To
let Connie go.
Well, I can't make it yet, Norbert. Because don't forget that as soon as you turn on the rotation, you get this, and you have to unravel all that. And so this is not something where there is no degeneracy in the way we work for the moment. There is. It's not too bad, but there is a diversity of effects that changes these patterns that we measure. And rotation is one of them, and this, near core boundary extra mixing, let's call it like that, is one of the effects.
But it looks like rotation's main effect is the slope.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas mixing is the amplitude.
Yes, and that's why I'm not too worried about degeneracies, because these are two different things that we can measure quite well. Okay. So, okay, then this comparison, something I want to say about that. For the moment, we're doing this in a frequentist approach, in the sense that I'm not using any prior knowledge, because this scheme, we have been able to apply it since 2015. We have yet to learn a lot. And so now, 2 years later, we have seen so many stars, many for me is tens of stars, and the we can recognize very easily dipole prograde mode. So I'm not worried about putting a prior here in that respect. Yeah. But here, of course, you have to couple back to the frequency precision, because if your reduced chi-square is 1, let's say, then our models do a fine job in the very naive statistical interpretation. Typically, this reduced chi-square is at a few thousands, just to give you an idea. This is not different for solar-like oscillations in red giants. There it is also very, very far away from 1. So even in low-mass stars, when you scale the Sun, I mean, people have done the low-hanging fruit now, and we can rank models with different input physics, but they don't meet the precision of the frequencies at all for the time being. Yeah. So you may run into the question like, well, if you do that decently in terms of statistical model comparison, we also have still a lot to do, because it's not so trivial if your chi-squares are so high, how you can derive the errors on these parameters in an appropriate way. This is what people have not been doing so far. Because
it's putting the cart before the horse to start estimating errors when you don't even have a good fit. I mean, it's kind of saying the model does not work.
Yes.
I'm saying that the model doesn't work.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
So then talking about errors in the model is just totally, like...
I know. So we have to work on this box. That's what we learned, which is a very important conclusion. But, you know, that's time-consuming.
Can we be sure it's that box and not the translation to the reflection frequency?
Sorry?
Can we be sure it's that box and not the translation to the
oscillations? Yes, I'm very certain of the frequencies of the oscillations and of the mode identification. I'm not worried about that anymore. No.
Reach us off the whole time, screw
telling you that for years, Bill.
Yeah, I
know. That's all my things, right? Because, of course, the physics and the models, we will have to work forever on that.
Yes.
But if you say, I just assume there are 6 parameters which determine my physics,
yeah,
and to do at least chi-square fit on these parameters,
yes,
it's a mathematically well-posed question.
Yes.
And so that was at the bottom of your previous slide.
Sure.
And so the question is, has that converged?
So that's what that's fine for the moment. You mean this is the easy part, right?
No, that's the solved part.
It is.
It's easy because it's solved, because Rich made it solved.
It's linear.
It's linear.
The rotational effects are still very challenging.
Yes, but I'm doing a slow rotator for the time being. Exactly for that reason. But so this comparison is fine if you stick to this being, you know.
You have to assume a falsity if that's reasonable.
And this is not the case.
There are huge uncertainties coming out of that to dwarf all of your uncertainties on the right hand side.
So that means with these 6 parameters you can fit all these mountains of period spacing, which are, you know, which is a very complicated pattern.
Up to 1% relative precision of the measured frequency.
That's mathematically almost impossible. How does that work? Because, I mean, physics in the stars certainly is not that simple.
Well, I'm only using this diagram. Well, here, you see the nice observations. And these are, by the way, no dips. Huh? So they are more mixed and they are more rapidly rotating. That makes sense, right? But if you then go, this is a typical case where we have the model and the measured data. This rotates quite fast for my standards. It's 25% critical. So the difference, here's what you have to look at. The difference between the observed and the theoretically predicted frequencies is at 1%. That's quite good.
How do I judge that? The right part fits perfectly, the left part?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, the other way.
So the mixing is not correct. Because the mixing determines how the dips behave at a specific frequency, and we are not doing a good job here.
Could you change your six parameters such that you fit the right part better, but not the left part?
No. This is a globally best solution from a 6D grid of, you know, millions of models with very refined step, and we're always screwed in this part and in this part. And that has to do with the radial, so at low radial order and at high radial order that we, of the whole measured sequence of modes, we're not doing well enough in the mode trapping of these modes.
Connie, looking at that plot, I don't quite understand how the top and the bottom figures are related. If I look in the bottom figure, well, the fractional error is less than 1%.
Relative, huh?
The relative error. But if I look up at the top, theory versus observation, the second point from the left, the error is about 400 out of 2,000.
In period spacing, but this is This is frequency.
Sorry, yeah.
That's what we measure directly, okay?
And you have measurements of frequencies at unbelievable precision.
Yes. It's one. It's reverse. Huh?
Well, so it's the period spacing, not the period.
Yeah. Yes. And so, if I were to draw this type of figure for a solar type astroseismology application of P modes, nicely behaved, easy, it's the same, huh? Of course, this is not written in the papers because they do 10,000s of stars in bulk as an ensemble. But this is not worse. So we're not doing well. I mean, we're not doing a perfect job, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we have now a handle on how to derive the core mass, which is sort of the average period spacing, the tilt, which is the near core rotation frequency, and this star has dips. So if we describe the diffusive mixing in the near core overshoot region, either with this double diffusive mixing or this silly green, you know, stuff, we can't go above 100 centimeters squared per second. And so I want to know how that compares with the theoretical. Maybe you know by heart, Norbert. I don't think we are in contradiction, because the graphs that are predicted from the theory are not constant at all. So.
But that what you're really comparing to is not the quality of this pit, but actually the depth of the dips.
That's right.
Which well, is predicted, right? That's something completely different than what you measure here in the chi-square.
We're comparing each and every measured frequency of oscillation with this theoretical prediction.
Yeah, but right? You're saying your stars have dips, and so that's the difference between the dip and the peak, so to speak. Right.
Yes, but the models also have the dips, huh? So I'm not sure I understand your worry here. So our chi-square is simply this minus this squared, and weight with the error on the frequency as it comes out of the light curve. Yeah, Daniel, what's your way?
All right, so here what you're doing is that you have your six parameters.
Yes.
And then you use MESA or whatever.
Yes.
Run pulsation code and see if it matches.
Uh-huh.
All right, and you find that this is the best that you get.
Yes.
But there's some discrepancies at low periods.
Yes.
Which is persistent in all the models.
Yes.
Right.
In all, yeah.
So a different way that you could do it is do the inversion problem and ask what structure at this time
do you need.
And you could ask what features does that structure have that make it different from all of the models.
I know, but we have about 30 modes, and doing the inversion of the integrals with G modes only is just not constraining enough.
So
that's what I totally agree, that's where we're heading for, but we are not yet there. The discrimination between the modes is too small.
So you've tried doing the inversions?
Sorry?
You've tried doing the inversions?
Well, for the rotation of this, you know, this very...
For rotation, but what about for, like, Brownian frequency?
Very first sets.
Okay.
That's what we want to do,
yeah,
of course.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
How much will the structure have to change to match this? Is this a big change in the structure? Is it, you know...
Well, let me maybe end with this because we're running out of time. But just to show, for us, opacity is very important, right? And so we tweaked the input physics in, or checked how much it matters if you use opal or op or whatever. And the mixture also, because for the, yeah, helio seismologists tend to impose the solar mixture upon us, but for massive stars, not necessarily the same. So here's just for one of these stars, the six different combinations that we used to check if how it changes the frequency values. So, and you see that here. This is what I meant when in the conference, Frank Timmy's micro versus macro physics question came up. Like, how important is this? And for us, this is totally less important than trying to describe the overshoot in a decent way. That's just not helping us. So the discrepancy does not come from using different opacities and mixtures within a certain test cases that we have done. Okay. And then degeneracies here, we know there's a mass metallicity degeneracy, which is why we are still in need of the metallicity. But the rest is fine. So there is the aging, so to speak. Yeah. I mean, there are degeneracies, but they are not so strong. That's the central hydrogen fraction versus the metallicity, and so this we know. We have known it already from ground-based data. So we can only break it if we have a good measurement of the metallicity.
So this is saying you need a non-zero demix to get high square depth.
We need a non-zero demix. That's my conclusion of all this work after 3 years of effort. But still, it's an important discussion.
Yeah. Non-zero.
Yeah.
Non-zero, non 10 to the 6.
Yes.
Yeah.
I need a near core boundary demix between 10 and 1,000 centimeters squared per second if I look at the whole ensemble of 50 stars that we have. But we haven't tuned it. You know, doing this star by star is really a lot of work.
This demix is only going to have an impact on places where there is a composition gradient, so it's not going to do anything out of the uniform composition. It's going to only be impacting the regions close to the convective zone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, it's interesting that the astroseismology is revealing that the same problem with near boundary mixing that Anne and I have been running into with more helium burning.
Yes.
And just as a one sentence or two sentence update on that, working with Anne and Evan, we turned on element diffusion,
mm-hmm.
and we found that supplies the necessary mixing to allow the core to grow as it should.
Yes.
So, you know, there's there are other mixing processes that could provide what's missing in the...
But if you do atomic diffusion for this type of stars, it's so fast, it's one of these Ds that I deleted.
That's
different. That's different than the Ds in MESA. Element diffusion's handled totally separately.
Right. That's right. But it's handled for helium, right?
You can do it for metals too.
You can do it for different species.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's smaller.
I haven't experimented with
it. It's way smaller than 10. Or, you know, if you're saying you need like 10 to 1,000, element diffusion is never close to that.
Well, at the surface, it's pretty fast. That's one of the problems.
But but I'm not at the surface. Yeah. I need it at the core.
And the gradients will never be steep
enough. But it will change things at the surface if you put it in, then you'd have a totally different set of models.
I know. So that's not for these stars the way to go, I think.
Plus, you see metals and helium, I hope, and you see stuff. So that diffusion is getting undone somehow.
It's not well treated, I think, in the near core boundary of a main sequence star, unless you tell me I'm wrong. But that's not something I can just plug in.
It's not very important at the core boundary.
No. No, I'm not suggesting element diffusion was sort of your problems. What I'm pointing out is that there is a commonality of issues across the HR diagram that deal with mixing near the core boundary.
Yes, that deal with mixing in general, I would say. Yeah.
Well, to clarify also Rich's comment, it's not that the physics of element diffusion is exactly what was needed, but sort of more that some sort of mixing analogous to that. Right. I mean,
so, I mean, you saw my most recent email where I just put in the same green mixing, the same anonymous floron demix that achieved exactly the same.
It doesn't have to be element
diffusion. Yes. Something's going on. I
mean, is that for core helium burning?
This is for core helium burning stars.
Yeah. Because,
so I put in log demix is 1.
Yes.
And that made the core grow as it should.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Conclusion of this, that Schwarzschild is the wrong flavor of mixing.
I mean, we kind of know that from the 3D simulations as well, right? We know that the simple prescriptions we have right now that we're typically using in our stars is not the exact, doesn't have the same flavor. It's not that it's not, we're using the wrong coefficient, it's not the same flavor as what the...
Okay.
So I have a question about rotational splitting. Do you see rotationally split modes in these in the star?
In some? In a few. Very few. And so we can do the near core rotation from the tilt, which is not from splitting. That's just the tilt of the period spacing pattern. And for a few stars, 2 or 3, we also see the splitting itself. So we can estimate, we can do sort of an inversion of the rotation estimate. We have core versus surface rotation. We have more. And they agree very well.
So why don't you see splitting in more of them? Is the rotation too slow? Are those split modes not excited?
We do see for, you know, I can only do statistics on F stars because we have 50 stars there. And so for about 15 of the 50, we also see retrograde modes, dipole retrograde modes. But these are Rossby modes, but Rich will study them in detail.
I think it's worth saying that for these stars, they're rotators, most of them. So it's not just splitting, it's like, all the prograde modes get shifted to higher frequency, and all the retrograde modes get shifted to lower frequency.
Yeah.
And so it's not just this first order small splitting. It's
right.
The modes really shift a lot.
But do you take that into account when you're matching everything?
That's what Connie's been working on.
We are trying.
We're trying to.
But yeah, so far we have been using Rich's traditional approximation for rotation, which for G modes is fine because the approximation that you make on your rotation vector is okay. So you get a generalization of the simple LM description in terms of solving the Laplace size equation. So that we do in the matching of the frequencies. I didn't want to go into that detail.
Okay, I know it's technical. A lot of detail. It's just I think it's really seems overwhelming to deal with that, but you're making progress. That's,
well, thanks to Gyra.
I don't know, I have to learn about what you just said. Can
you say something about the excitation? So how are these ones excited?
So the excitation is that was discussed earlier this week by Jacqueline, so I didn't go into detail. It's what I have to call, since I wrote that book, a heat mechanism, but it's the kappa mechanism that excites the most in the opacity bump of iron-like elements. And I should say that we don't use this here in our modeling a priori because the excitation doesn't work perfectly fine. So we use the frequencies that we measure, and then a posteriori we check if we now do non-adiabatic pulsation computation that takes into account the excitation, do we get them excited, yes or no? And let's say 90% of the detected frequencies are predicted to be excited, but a few are not, and these are the few, again, on the sides where we have the least well-matched frequency values. You know, some groups prefer to only consider modes in doing modeling that are predicted to be excited. I don't do that because then you know that you're already making some mistake from the start. But I mean, it's not a black and white discussion, of course, because we also want to learn about excitation. We do it a posteriori. And then we see that we can get all the modes excited quite easily if we increase a little bit iron and nickel. So we're doing sort of a observational tuning of what we would need as opacities to get all the detected modes excited. That was done by Esam Moravici in one of his papers. So
a very basic question, which maybe is too simple for you, or maybe too silly, I don't know. So in an, even in a non-rotating star, you say that you have these mostly horizontal motions from these oscillations, or vertical. So what is there in a star, you know, where most things are depending on radius, that turns on, that things kind of twist, you know, in
that's buoyancy.
That's,
I mean, we have
buoyancy works up and down. First order.
Yeah, it prevents the motions from being up and down. But there's nothing restricting motions from being side to side.
Yeah.
So that's the classical gravity wave, is that particles can move side to side, but not up and down. So they tend to have large side to side motions, but not up and down, because of buoyancy. So that's what a gravity mode is.
The same one.
They can move easier horizontally, but still something should start pushing them. Again.
There's pressure forces. There are pressure forces. Yeah.
But they're not, their radial motion is not zero. Eh? It's typically factor 10 for this difference between horizontal versus vertical. So it's not that it's zero. But if I were to make an approximation, I delete the radial component and not the transversal component. But of course, you have the two forces acting as restoring force. It's just that buoyancy is the dominant restoring force in this case. So that's what implies the horizontal motion.
I have also a basic question about this linear trend of the spacing with rotation, with rotation. Why, how is it that it's the long, the coefficient, this, is there a simple formula for this?
So we're doing only very simplistic. So as said, the equilibrium star is assumed to be non-rotating and spherically symmetric. And then you perturb it, and then you assume you're in the linear regime. And so in the approximation that we are using, the rotation is assumed to be only Coriolis force. No centrifugal force at all. This is not taken into account. And then you can have an easy formula of the shift that your rotation implies on the oscillation frequencies.
How is this formula? What is the slope of this?
Well, it's, we call,
it's proportional to the rotation frequency, but what is the coefficient?
That's right. So the coefficient depends on the stellar structure, and that you can compute from the type of mode.
But the first order, there's no simple
expression. First order, you can write that down. So there is a very simplistic formula that takes into account the Coriolis force effect in this factor here called the Ledoux splitting, which is dependent on the type of mode that you have. And so this factor here, when you have rigid rotation, you can write it down in this simplistic form. Yeah. So that's the first order approximation that we are using. So as soon as you turn on the rotation, you shift your frequencies according to the azimuthal order, and you lift the degeneracy that you would otherwise have if you have no rotation. Yeah. But of course, the shift is quite large if you have G modes, because the frequencies are so low. So even with a low value of the rotation frequency, you still make a big difference, and that's why there is this clean slope, let's say. Yeah.
So this CNN?
That depends on the stellar structure. So that's an integral of, if you were to do it, that's a function, we call it a kernel, and then you have your rotation frequency over your star, assuming that you have no differential rotation in the azimuthal. And so this depends on your stellar structure equations, let's say.
For high-order G-modes, there is an approximation. You can approximate it just as 1 over L times L plus 1.
Yeah, so this CNL is asymptotically is fully determined by the degree of the mode.
It's simply, you said
1 over L times L plus 1.
In the slow rotation limit.
But that's a very slow rotation
and,
limit.
And high
rigid.
Order.
Yeah. And rigid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And high order N. But, you know.
So in using that, you're assuming the value of N.
Yeah, because we have identified that it's prograde dipole modes, that these are all prograde dipole. I know that now. It's simple, but we didn't know that 3 years ago. And so again, these are, you know, this is fair. Even though the series is, this star is very young, for instance, has no dips. That's what the that's the purple line that I had. So it, somehow it all makes sense. Here also. But we have to do star by star to see, you know, if the disappearance of dips has to do with age or with mixing, in whatever. Of whatever cause, and these two are to be disentangled. But we're running far over time, so.
Okay, so that's fine, Bonnie.